No.
So we have to do this.
Welcome to Hot Grease. I'm your host, Nicole Taylor. This Heritage Radio Network program is brought to you by 360 Cookware. 360 Cookware is a top-of-the-line stainless steel cookware that is made in America in the greenest cookware manufacturing facility in the country. It can be used to make all your favorite recipes, but it also gives the option to cook using vapor technology, which creates a seal that surrounds food with intense heat, locking in vitamins, moisture, and flavor without added oil, fat, or excessive water. Visit their website at 360cookware.com for more information. Every week on Hot Grease, we bring people back to what's great in food, culinary traditions, cooking at home, knowing your farmer, or even growing your own vegetables. I spotlight good food fighters and the culture of the good food movement, from chefs to tastemakers to moms on a budget. Today, we'll be talking red velvet cake, 40 food thinkers, and Green Book's blogger review. If you're listening live to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network, our call-in number is 718-497-2128. On November 10th, 2010, bloggers, actually 200 bloggers, will take a stand to support books printed in an eco-friendly manner by all publishing reviews of 200 books printed on recycled or FSC certified paper. The campaign is organized for the second time by EcoLibris, a green company working to make reading more sustainable. And the book that I am reading for Green Book's blogger review is titled Reimagining Detroit: Opportunities for Redefining an American City. And it's by John Gallagher. Friend of the show, Kate Payne. She was on one of our shows. She has a blog titled Hip Girl's Guide to Homemaking. She's participating in this. I think she's reading a book called The Sharing Solution, How to Save Money, Simplify Your Life, and Build a Community. One of our upcoming guests, she'll be on the show in November, Liz Neves. Her blog is titled Ragnella. She is reading Participating in Nature, Wilderness, Survival, and Primitive Living Skills. So listen out on November 11th. But I just wanted to highlight really quickly my book. And as I'm completing the book and getting ready to write my review, I thought it was really cool to talk about the chapter in this book. And this book is all about Detroit and what Detroit can do to change their shrinking city problem. The chapter that I'm reading is most interesting. It's called Potential and Problems in Urban Agriculture. And they are talking a lot about what's been done in the past around urban agriculture and what could do to strengthen all of Detroit. I found this really cool video that I want to share with you guys. It's Amy Goodman from Democracy Now. She has a great podcast. If you guys are into podcasts, I know you are. Because you might be listening to this via podcast. She's interviewing the director of the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network, and he is talking about urban ag in Detroit. Listen to the video.
And family gardens. D-Town Farm is one of the biggest urban farms in Detroit. It was founded by the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network, a coalition of organizations and individuals working to build food security in Detroit's black community. Malik Yakini is the chair of the group. He gave us a tour of D-Town Farm.
Welcome to D-Town Farm. D-Town Farm is a community self-determination project operated by the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network. And this is a 2-acre site inside of a city-owned park. This is inside of Rouge Park, which is the largest park in the city of Detroit. And so we have obtained a 10-year license agreement to create a model organic farm here in the city of Detroit. And so what we're doing is we're showing how unused and underutilized land in the city of Detroit can be put to productive use, both to create greater access to fresh produce, also to mobilize people to work on their own behalf, and also to again demonstrate to people how land in the city, we have an abundance of land which is either not being used or being underutilized, how that land can be put to productive use. We have, so far, we've got two types of kale planted, curly leaf kale and what we call dinosaur kale or lacinato kale. We have onions planted, we have chives planted, we've got yellow squash planted, we've got tomatoes, we've got lettuce, we've got watermelon, peas, and a few other things. Ultimately, we'll have 37 different things planted. Community food security is a concept that basically means that a community has adequate amounts of culturally appropriate food that's easily accessible by people. And, you know, we like to add on it's grown by sustainable means. So when a community is in that condition, we consider it to be food secure. If any of those elements are missing, we consider the community to be food insecure. Detroit has been designated as a food desert by Mari Gallagher, who came here and did research in 2007. And she defined a food desert as a place where residents have to travel twice as far to get to a major grocer as they do to get to what she calls a fringe food location, or what we call in Detroit a party store. So we have this real serious problem in Detroit with the lack of access to fresh and healthy produce, which has tremendous health implications. So we have lots of problems in Detroit with obesity, both childhood and adult obesity, high blood pressure, diabetes, and other diseases which are controllable by diet. There used to be, when I was growing up in Detroit, at least 6 or 7 major supermarkets, national supermarkets in the city. As of 2007, when Farmer Jack left the city, there are no major chains in the city. So there are smaller markets, but often the quality of the food sold in the city of Detroit is a diminished quality when compared to the quality of the food that's sold in the ring of suburbs surrounding Detroit. Where black self-determination is, frankly. And Detroit is at least 85 or perhaps 90% African-American city. So any plan being proposed in relationship to urban agriculture in Detroit must benefit the majority population. We're not interested in plans that come in where the corporate sector comes in and only uses the majority population as workers. We're concerned about control and ownership. And so this is an example of an agricultural project which is controlled by African Americans, and where we're able to control the revenue generated from this farm. And we want to model not only the growing techniques, but model the kind of social and political and economic dynamics that we think are appropriate for a city like Detroit. Part of the challenge we have with organizing African Americans for this work is that many of our people associate this work with enriching somebody else, associated with slavery or with sharecropping, both of which enriched whites through our labor. And part of what we're doing is reframing agriculture for African Americans so that we can again see it as an act of self-determination and self-empowerment, as opposed to an act where our labor is exploited to enrich someone else.
So if you are just tuning in to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network, I'm taking the first segment to talk about the book that I am reading, Reimagining Detroit, Opportunities for Redefining an American City. And you were just listening to a Democracy Now! Segment interviewing the director of Detroit Black Community Food Security Network. And I'm reading this book again, part of Green Bloggers 2010, Green Books Blogger Review 2010. So look out November 10th, 200 bloggers all over the world will post all of these reviews about books, from Detroit to community gardening to how to save money. But I just want to say this last one thing about Detroit. I've had so many different conversations with people who are native Detroit folks or residents of Detroit, and everybody is talking about jobs. And it seems that the everyday folks in Detroit are having a hard time visioning rebuilding middle class life through urban farms. And this book really doesn't touch on this a lot, but hopefully in my review, I'll do a little paragraph to wrap up the book, but also bring up that issue, how folks are not really responding to this whole urban ag movement and rebuilding middle class life in Detroit. So November 10th, we'll talk about it some more. We're going to take a short break. Keep listening to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network.
All right, y'all, enough talk.
Welcome back to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network. Check out our program schedule and show archives on heritageradionetwork.com. If you're listening live now and you're on Twitter, be sure to follow Heritage Radio Network at HRN Updates. HRN Updates. That's our Twitter handle. You can also follow me, Nicole Taylor. I am Food Culturist on Twitter. Last week, one of the hottest conversations on my Food Culturist Facebook page and Twitter timeline was red velvet cake. I was like, wow, this is what I need to put up to get people like totally engaged in a food conversation. It was hilarious. Some of the comments I had, Tiffany, she lives in Harlem. She's been on the show before. She was saying that Take My Cake, which is a bakery in Harlem, they have two locations, is the best red velvet cake in the city. I'm like, no way, Tiffany. I actually made a trip to Harlem to check out Take My Cake. It was okay. You guys, if you've listened to the show before, you know I'm from the South, born and raised in Georgia. And I would like to say that I've had real red velvet cake. And Take My Cake, nah. Tiffany also said, what is it? Centrella, the like corner market, is another one of her favorite spots for red velvet cake. I'm not sure. Another two spots I have to bring up. Everyone in Brooklyn, they're always going on and on and on. And you've probably seen one of the places on Food Network is Cake Man Raven and Michael Allen. Okay, again, I don't think Cake Man Raven has pecans on his red velvet cake. Maybe you can order one with pecans. To me, a traditional red velvet cake always has pecans. So I'm not sure. And I think that Cake Man Raven actually was closed for not paying his employees or some kind of health code violation. I'm not sure what's going on with him. But I tried Michael Allen's red velvet cupcake. Disappointed. The cake was dry. And the top or the icing, I'm not sure what it was. It was so hard. It wasn't cream cheese. But I want to highlight some keys to great red velvet cake because people always ask me. So what's the deal? What is a Southern red velvet cake? The first thing is cocoa. I think a lot of people just put red food coloring in their cake. And some vegan or hardcore people think it's absolutely gross that people are putting dye in cakes. I've heard of people putting beet juice to color the cake a red. And I'm like, that is not a red velvet cake. I hear what you're saying, but it's not a traditional Southern red velvet cake. So two things you must have, and that is red food coloring and cocoa. You have to have cocoa and not too much cocoa because you don't want it to be a chocolate cake. I've had so many different red velvet cakes with I don't know what kind of icing, but definitely not cream cheese frosting. A traditional Southern red velvet cake needs cream cheese frosting and pecans, please. If you have nut allergies, I'm sorry. Don't have the cake. You have to have pecans on a traditional red velvet cake. The other thing I think makes the best red velvet cake is top ingredients. My aunt Jean, who is not the best cook, but she can make a damn good red velvet cake. She always told me to make a good red velvet cake, you are going to spend money because you need the best ingredients. She would buy the best vanilla, always white lily flour, which you cannot find in the North. Most people who know about baking and live in the South or know about some Southern traditions, you need white lily flour, I think, to make a really good red velvet cake. And two other things. You need to make a red velvet cake or cupcake in small batches. I think a lot of times at these bakeries, they're making these big, huge batches of cake, and it just loses something. It loses the very, you know, personalized feel, or maybe that's me. Maybe that's just in my mind knowing that they're making a whole bunch of cakes. And the other thing is, my aunt did not have a stand mixer. She had a hand electronic mixer. And I promise that has to have some effect on how great or not so great a cake is. So another thing is, I think if a person is trying to make a classic Southern red velvet cake, maybe you need to not use your stand mixer. And just go old school, you know, go to Brooklyn Flea and find you a hand electronic mixer and see if that changes the texture of your cake. So for all you folks who are listening and who chimed in to the Twitter, Facebook conversation about red velvet cake, yeah, there's not a place in New York City that has the best red velvet cake. And I have officially given up on trying to find that place. But if you just so happen to have a suggestion, I'm not going to purchase it. You can invite me to your house, buy a piece, and then invite me to the house, and I'll come by and taste a piece because I refuse to spend another dime on it. Email me, Nicole@foodcultures.com, if you have any suggestions. So there it is for all the folks sent me personal messages, wanted to know about my take on the Southern red velvet cake. There it is. We are going to take a short break and come back with the 40 Big Food Thinkers on Heritage Radio Network. Welcome back to Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Nicole Taylor. Hot Grease is produced by Jack Inslee and engineered by Nat Wiener. This program is being sponsored by 360 Cookware, top-of-the-line stainless steel cookware that's made in America. For more information, go to 360cookware.com. Let me give a Southern Girl's hug to Roberta's Restaurant, located at 261 Moore Street in Brooklyn, New York, the location of two sustainable shipping containers known as Heritage Radio Network. We love a list on Hot Grease. You guys know that. From the Hot Five to listing our favorite things and red velvet cake like we just did. But Food and Wine had a great list titled Big 40, 40 Thinkers Under 40. And it was in their November 2010 issue. It's actually online and in print. And they basically list 40 big thinkers in food. And I thought I would highlight some of my favorites, some people that I love. I either follow them on Twitter or I have their blog in my RSS feed, or I'm picking up their products. So I thought I would highlight a few. The first one is Matt Timms. Our very own Matt Timms made the list. Matt Timms hosts a bunch of cook-offs. I actually participated in his grits cook-off. And I think recently, last month, he did a lamb or bacon one here in New York City. But essentially, Matt Timms goes around the country and he hosts cook-offs from Austin, Texas. I think he's been to the West Coast, to the Midwest, and he is on the list. He has a show on Heritage Radio Network titled Mind Kitchen. So what's up, Matt Timms, if you're listening? Another person on the list, Zach Brooks. I've never met Zach in person, but I heard him speak last year at Astor Center. And he was talking about street vendors in New York City. Zach actually started MidtownLunch.com. Started here in New York, and I think Zach actually lives in LA now, and there's an LA version and a few other cities of Midtown Lunch. He's on Twitter. I know you can find Midtown Lunch on Twitter, but he's on the list. I think he's brilliant. I think he's smart to be to start a website like several years ago. So what's up, Zach? We have to connect. I always hear your name. So hey, he's on the list. Who else? Roberta's, our very own Roberta's. They've gotten a lot of press lately. They're on the list. Brandon and Chris are featured on the slideshow. If you go to foodandwine.com, you'll see them on the list. Another one of my favorites. I just found out about them recently, and then they popped up on the list, and I'm like, okay, they're food big thinkers. And that's One King's Lane, which is essentially the guilt group for a home. So instead of having a bunch of clothes, if you're listening and you've never gone or shopped on guilt.com or guiltgroup.com, you basically go on. It's like a online sample sale of all kind of designers. But One King's Lane is the equivalent, but it's all home stuff. And she does, or the owners have a lot of cookware on there, or tabletop stuff, or even food products. But I didn't realize that she was a food thinker, but okay, I love it. So she's on the list. Check them out. One King's Lane. And I didn't write down the two founders of the website here on my sheet, but you can find it. Just Google them. Next up on the list, this so reminds me of my friend Meg Pasca, the beekeeper. She's been on the show twice because she so needs to do a store like this in Brooklyn. And this store is Urban Farm Store, and it's in Portland, Oregon. And I think that it's actually an online store and a physical store in Portland where you can get baby chicks. You can get supplies for all your urban gardening needs. And I keep thinking, I cannot believe there's not a place like that in Brooklyn. Can you believe that? Not one place in Brooklyn. I don't know of any other places in the Northeast or even in Georgia that have this, you know, that's getting a lot of media attention, that's doing something similar to Urban Farm Store. So great idea, guys, Urban Farm Store. Maybe we'll get something like that in the New York area or some other really cool city. We'll create a farm store. Other people on my list. Sam Cass. All I have to say is the Obamas, Michelle Obama. I really don't know his job. Does anyone know his job? He's like a White House special chef, special projects guy or whatever. He is really cute. And he's on the list of 40 big food thinkers under 40. Don't we love him? Yeah, and another one, Foodzy.com, which is essentially, I would call them the Etsy of foods. You can go and find all kind of food products. And the owners, Emily Olson and Rob Lefebvre, they've done a great job in finding the best of the best and put it in one big place. So I want to say thank Food and Wine for coming up with this really cool list. It actually inspired me because I'm like, I don't see a lot of different people on this list. I didn't see a lot of food activists that were of color. So I'm going to, in the next month or so, I think I'm going to do a very special list, kind of like a grassroots underground list of people all over the country, 40 people, maybe not 40, maybe I'll start off with 20 that are doing really cool things, but maybe not getting a lot of media attention. So this food and wine list really inspired me to create this list, and also just inspired me in general to see so many young people doing great things, like my yogurt guy. He's on there too, Sig's Yogurt. So listen out. I'll probably do it the show before 2011. I'll create a list. Maybe I'll get some of the people on my list on the show. So look out for it. So folks, thank you for listening to Hot Grease. We have some very exciting shows coming up in November. You won't be hearing me talk the whole time. Very cool guests. Next week, which is November 1, we're going to have the folks behind the next big small brand. They're going to be on Hot Grease the entire hour. The first competition last year, we had the winner on the show. We had them on the show talking about next big small brand, and they're going to come on the show again to talk about the competition. So if you have a food or food product, go to their website, go to their Twitter feed, check them out, or more so listen to the show next week. We'll have all the cool details. So thanks for listening live. If you just pressed play on your MP3 player, thanks for listening. Until then, always take the road less traveled.